First Timothy chapter 6, I'll be reading from verse 6 through 12. But godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into the world and we could take nothing out of it. But if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. People who want to get rich fall into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires that plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Some people eager for money have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs. But you, man of God, flee from all this and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, endurance, gentleness. Fight the good fight of the faith. Take hold of eternal life to which you were called when you made your good confession in the presence of many witnesses.
Well, good to see everyone is out this morning. We welcome you to the church at East Orange if you've not been here before. And we hope you'll want to come and be back with us on a regular basis. If you have not done so, you probably will find a visitor's card located just in front of you, and we'd like for you to fill that out. We'd like to have a record of you being here with us. This morning, I'm going to ask a very simple question. You can tell from the title of the lesson and perhaps from the reading that James just did for us that we're going to be talking about godliness. And if you'll notice the way that I subtitled the lesson, we're going to talk about the profit that there is in godliness. And in particular, we're going to talk about the real worth of living the life. I want to suggest to you that there are basically two different kinds of members of the church. Christians, if you will. One is a very frustrated individual. And this is not to judge where anyone who's here, where your heart is. This is for you, as Wes was talking about. You need to judge yourself and ask the question, what is the worth in living the life? What's the profit in godliness? But one is a very frustrated individual. He or she knows the kind of life that they should be living. It is the life that at some point in time, when they obeyed the gospel, they committed to living. They chose, by the very fact that they repented before they were baptized, they chose to live a certain kind of life, a life that would be subject to Jesus, our Lord, a life that would be in harmony with His will, and one that would always be growing, progressing toward the goal of being, well, very simply put, just like Him. In a very real sense, we were committing when we obeyed the gospel to asking a question every day, really about all things. What would Jesus do? And we try to answer that question, what would Jesus do or what would He have me to do? And whatever the answer was, we'd do that. But we haven't done that, and so we're frustrated. We try to waver, as it were, sort of like on Mount Carmel, when Elijah confronted the people and basically challenged them. If God is God, follow Him. If Baal or something else is God, then follow that. But don't try to limp, as it were, or be crippled between the two sides. That's a frustrated life. It's not a happy life. It is a life that is always down on yourself or something. And it's a life that, in a spiritual sense, is going nowhere, and you feel that. Now, on the other hand, there is a very contented individual. This is the person that committed to Jesus Christ, obeyed the gospel, repented, and obeyed the gospel. And from the time that they were baptized, even if they have wavered at times, right now in their life, they really are committed. They're doing their best. If you were to ask that person, are you perfect? They'd quickly say, no, no, not by a long shot. Am I perfect? But if you were to ask them, are you doing your best? They would say, yeah, I'm really trying to do the best I can. And they're content with that. It doesn't mean that they're content to stay where they are. They want to grow. They want to progress. That's not what Paul is saying. But they live godly lives. They make choices on a daily basis where they choose to do right rather than wrong. And they feel good about themselves for that. They don't feel arrogant. They're not boastful. It's not that at all. It is just a happy, blessed, contented life. Now, that's what I want to talk about this morning. The worth of living the life. And I'm going to approach it from a very practical standpoint. So we talk about the prophet in godliness. Paul says, if you look again at 1 Timothy chapter 4 this time, Paul says to Timothy in verse 8, bodily exercise does profit a little. I mean, it does help you in this life. The more you exercise, the better you feel physically. But on the other hand, godliness, and again, the idea of exercise, notice, practicing godliness, is profitable unto all things. And then notice, having the promise of the life that now is and of that which is to come. Now, I'm not going to turn and read it, but that's very much like Jesus saying in John 10 that if you follow him as one of the sheep of his pasture, you will in fact go in and out and find pasture. That's the idea of contentment. You will live a life that is more abundant than you would live without him, is the point. Godliness is profitable in all things. Notice again the passage that James read, just a couple of things from it. Paul tells Timothy again, godliness with contentment is great gain, verse 6. Notice that phrase, great gain there. The worth of living the life. And so as he goes on to say there in verse 11, the man of God is to follow or pursue. Literally the term has the idea of chasing, like a policeman would chase down a criminal. Pursue it, follow it, chase it down. So here's the idea of putting forth effort to live a godly life. Exercising yourself, if you will, in that pursuit. So we ask the question, what is godliness? If it's so important and it brings me such value in my life, well, what is it exactly? And we'll ask the second question, how does it really profit me? How am I better off? It seems that, and I understand fully. I can remember sitting in front of Dale and saying, I can't live a Christian life. I mean, it's a lot of thou shalts and thou shalt nots. And even if I do believe it, wasn't sure about all of it at that time, but even if I do believe it, I can't live it. I mean, there's just too much that you have to do and too much you have to give up to live a godly life or a Christian life. So how does it really profit you? If Christianity is about sacrifice, if following in the steps of Jesus is about sacrifice, we just sang a song. You know, no matter where it leads, no matter where I have to go, no matter what I have to do, you know, I will follow, and I'll follow in the steps of Jesus. But if it really is about sacrifice, how's that a lot of value? I understand value of going to heaven, value in the life that will be, but how now? Well, let's suggest some things. The word godliness means, and I just took a hodgepodge of different phrases, but it means to be devout. It means to be godly or godlike. It denotes piety or reverence. It's characterized, I like the way that Vines puts it in particular, it is characterized by an attitude of doing what is well-pleasing to God. And it's simple. It is as simple as that. If I'm living a godly life, it is as simple as I look in here, I say, what does God want me to do? Oh, okay, that's what I do. And when I live that life, God promises me, notice what Paul said, having the promise of the life that now is and the life which is to come. So God promises me if I live that life of being well-pleasing to God, I'll have a good life. It will be beneficial to me. There'll be value in it. There'll be profit in it, if you will. Notice in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 3. You can turn there and read it, or I put up a translation of it. God in His divine power has given unto us all things, and I want you to notice how He says it, all things that pertain unto life and godliness. Now notice what he does not say, because it's often read like this. Sometimes it's read and people will say, what that means is God has given us everything, the knowledge of Him. He's given us all the knowledge to live a godly life. Well, that is true. He has. But that's not all Peter says. Peter doesn't say all things that pertain unto a godly life. Peter says all things that pertain unto life and godliness. This is very much like what Paul is saying in 1 Timothy 4. the promise of the life that now is, and the one that is to come. In other words, both passages are viewing your life from the moment you're baptized, the moment you become a Christian, all the way through eternity. And what it is promising you is, that's a good life. God has given you everything you need to have life. You know, people say, you'll hear people saying, and a lot of times we'll hear this phrase, I need a life, or get a life, you know. And we all understand what that means. It means that whatever I'm doing now, or the situation of my life now, is death. It's just dead. There's nothing happening in my life. It's not worth living, quote unquote, or that's how I feel. It's not a good life. Well, but the Bible is telling us, God is telling us in both these passages, if you want a life, then live a godly life. That's the real life. And you know, it's understandable. I mean, just think about it for a moment from a, you know, from a logical point of view. Who made us? God made us. Who created the world? God created the world. Who put us here in this life? God did. Did God mean for this life to be a lousy life? And then, if you make it through this lousy life, then He'll give you heaven. I mean, does the Bible really teach that? Do we see that in so many passages in the Bible? The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, David said. Is David saying, really what I mean to say is, it's a lousy life, but I'm going to heaven? That's not what the Bible was saying. The Bible is teaching a good life. Go in and out and find pasture. The idea of a more abundant life. I am come that they may have life, Jesus said. Have life. And that they may have it more abundantly. Now, godliness profits us. And let's just suggest some different aspects of our life. First of all, materially. I realize that what is popular in the world, that is in the mindset of what a religious person ought to do, is to take a vow of poverty. That's the most godly life you can live. There is a need sometimes for people to take a vow of poverty. The rich young ruler was so wrapped up in his riches, he needed to take a vow of poverty. Because they were the things that kept him from God. But by and large, that's not what God teaches. God teaches not necessarily that you're going to have abundance of riches. You might. God might bless you with that. And if so, He will expect, like the one given 5 talents, He will expect you to take advantage of what you have and give it back and do good with it. But it's not necessarily that you're going to have a life of ease, and not necessarily that you're going to have a life of riches. Not necessarily you're not. But God does promise you'll have what you need. Sometimes our frustration in life is because, and I know this is true of me, may not be true of you, but it is of me. The frustration is when I'm not satisfied. The frustration is when I'm always looking at more, 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 more. I have this, yes, but I want to have that. I know I've got this, but I want to get that. That kind of thing. And those times are very frustrating times. Those times are not good times. That's not a good life. A good life basically approaches the day by saying, God, whatever I have, it's yours. It belongs to you. You know, the psalm, cattle of 1,000 hills belongs unto God. Everything I have belongs to God. And whatever you give me, if you bless me with more today, that will be yours as well. And whatever I have, I'll use it. And I'll use it for your will, your good, your kingdom. And I'll be happy and content in that. When we can get that attitude, being thankful, like Wes said, for whatever we have, and giving back to God, not just a part of it when we come here on Sunday and lay a portion of it in the basket, but all of it. Everything I have every day, God has given it to me, it belongs to me. But also the contentment of knowing. We're not going to read through Matthew 6, but I trust you know the passage. Jesus said, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They don't toil. They don't spin. And yet Solomon, who was perhaps the richest man the world has ever known, and I mean Buffett and Gates included, I mean, there's some massive riches there, let's be honest. But Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Or think of the birds of the air. You know, they're always fed. There's always food for them. What Jesus says, the basic necessities of life, the food, the shelter, the clothing. Like Paul said in the passage that James read, having food and raiment, we shall be there with content. It's the idea of knowing every day, I don't need to worry. If I live godly, if that's my priority. Now you have to look at verse 33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. But it is the contentment, the satisfaction of knowing I'll have what I need. I don't know what else God will bless me with. I don't know what I'll have in life. And it becomes more of a wait and see and be excited about what you get. You know, thank God for it. Do your best. Pursue your ambitions and so forth. But the idea of the knowledge, the contentment, that as long as I'm doing what's right, and that's first in my life, God will take care of it. Notice also that He profits us physically. Now, a person might say, how is that so? I know Christians that are blind. I know Christians that are crippled. I know a bunch of people here who have sicknesses. Notice what God is saying here. Godly people control their bodies. Our bodies are not perfect, not here. They weren't meant to be. The best of people and the best of health grow old and die. God teaches us that. And our bodies, no matter what we'd like to do to avert that, you know, they're not going to stay young forever, and they're going to waste away. And eventually, we are going to die. That's part of life. I don't believe that's what it's saying. I think what it's talking about is, just like you exercise your body in 1 Timothy 4 to profit. You know, and I know there have been times when I've exercised, it may not look like it, but there have been times when I've exercised my body, you know. And I've done all those things, you know, running and lifting weights and used to do martial arts and all of that. I mean, religiously. It was my religion. And so I know how your body can profit from all of that. But godliness profits as well when you control your body. Just think about it just from this aspect. We could talk about a lot of different things, but just from this aspect. Godly people bring their bodies under subjection. They're in subjection. They're under control is what I meant to say. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 27, that's exactly what Paul says. The King James says, I keep under my body and bring it into control, under control. The idea is bringing your body into subjection. You're in control. It's not. Now you think about the difference that that is and say the addict. The addict is out of control. The addict must have his body craves, desires, and demands it have what it longs for. Paul talks about that in a number of passages, and I put some of them up here, and there are many others to consider. You can jot these down or take a look at them. But all of these passages have the idea of bringing what is corrupt in your life, what is a great desire, intense desire of your flesh and even of your mind, bringing it under control. Even Colossians 3 and verse 5, putting it to death. It's a process. It takes work, but you can do it. But the idea of the individual who does that feels absolutely in control. I'm going to tell you a little story. And you probably, looking at me right now, you probably can't even picture this. But I was thinking back the other day and going back in time, back to when I was a teenager and, you know, and doing all those things that I mentioned earlier. And I remember I was out one day and I had you know, workout session, been to the school and had a workout session. And then it was a beautiful day and so I decided to start running. Now, I generally ran about a mile or 2 miles. I never was a huge runner, none of these marathon type things. But this day I decided I'm going to run a mile. But I ran and I felt so good. You know, the endorphins kicked in and all that, and I just felt good. And I remember standing on a street corner, and picture it right now. Street corner waiting for the light to change, and I'm jogging in place, and I'm feeling good. And so I decided, you know what, I'm just going to keep on running. And I just kept on running. I don't know how far I ran that day, but the more I ran, the better I felt. Now, what I'm saying in that is this. You know, most of us here have, you know, we've done sports or we've whatever. And there's been that point in time where you've done all the work and you feel really good. It's no different with your spiritual life. You go through the training and the pain and the bringing into subjection, and none of that sounds like fun. And let's be honest, it's not. It doesn't feel good when your body says, I want a drink. And you say, you ain't getting one. It doesn't feel good. Your body says, I want to commit fornication. And your mind and your heart say, well, you're not going to. Doesn't necessarily feel good. But I'll tell you what does feel good. When you're in control and your body is saying, we're not doing that anymore, are we? Might as well not ask. You feel in control and it feels good. Because all the beating up of yourself you do when you've done what's wrong is over. You're in control and you know it. You feel it. It's like I was that day running. There were times when I first started running and I first started training. You know, I was not one of those people really. Naturally, I'm one of those couch potato people. But there was a period in my life when I did all of that. And it was hard. It just did not want to get out there and do those things. But I did it. And that day, I understood what it was all for. It felt great. I'd like to get back to where I could do some of that, but it felt great is the point. Same thing spiritually. Godly people control their lives. And because of that, they're not harmed, they're not defiled by all of the promiscuity, the alcohol, the drugs, the tobacco, all the other things that go with it. You know, you look at a person. Just say those four things that I put up there. Let's just say you take your average person that drinks and does drugs and smokes and is promiscuous. You take an individual that does that and take another individual who doesn't. You look at them when they're both about 20 years old, and usually they both look about the same physically. Look at them when they're 40. Look at them when they're 50, if they live that long. And notice the difference. The body was not meant to be harmed and defiled by things such as that. The body was meant for God. And that's why I believe Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6 that things such as fornication are a sin against your body. Not just against, as it's at least one of the reasons, not just against God, but against your own body. Godliness profits us physically. Godly people obey the civil laws. And I won't go deeply into this, but you know, even things such as obeying the traffic laws lessen your chance of getting killed. Or being a peacemaker rather than a troublemaker. You're a lot less likely to get arrested, thrown in jail, killed, etc. It just profits you physically. But let's go further. It profits you mentally. Godly people are free. Or at least less so. The more godly you are, the more this will be the case of anxiety or worry. Now, you may not be a person given to worry. I am. I mean, that's just natural to me to worry. And there are a lot of reasons why. That may come from childhood, etc., etc. It doesn't matter. If you're a person given to it, if you worry about things, you know, what's going to happen if this happens and what's going to happen if that happens, then you realize the more godly you are, the less you worry. We think about that passage again in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus saying things like, take no thought for the morrow, etc. Or, be not anxious. The idea is, don't worry. Don't worry. Now, sometimes you want to look up at heaven and say to God, how can I not worry? This might happen, and that might happen, and that might happen. There's a good answer to that. God would answer back and say, I am in control. You go through the Old Testament, and I would challenge you to do this in your reading. I know a lot of you are on a very stringent reading schedule. But if not, then go home and look up this phrase, you know, punch it into the internet. Just look up the phrase, I am with you, and see how many times in the Word of God that God says to His people, I'm with you. The more you understand that, the more you meditate upon that, and that's what God would have you to do. The more you realize that you don't do anything without God. That there is no situation where God is not present. It doesn't matter if you're taking a shower or looking for a job. It doesn't matter if you're into it, so to speak, with other people or at peace with them. God is there. And that's why God says so many times, I am with you. I know that you need food, shelter, and clothing. I'm with you. I'm going to be there. Don't worry about it. You don't have to take thought. Jesus doesn't mean you don't sit down and say, hey, if I don't work, I don't eat. He's not saying that. The idea of thought here is when it dominates your thinking. It's when you're given to it. It's like the opposite of it in Philippians 4 when he says at the end of verse 8, think on these things. It means dwell on them. It's the idea of it being a thought that's always there. You know, if there's something in your life that about, you know, how you're going to eat your next meal or what, where you're going to live or all those kinds, if that's consuming your thinking because you're worried about it, then that's the one, that's what Jesus is talking about. Don't dwell on it. Know that if you live godly, if you put me first and my kingdom first, if you do that, I'll take care of it. Dwell on that. Be consumed with that. God comes first. The idea of godliness is that it brings happiness. It brings the knowledge of approval. There are a number of passages in the Bible. I'd like for you to turn with me to Psalm 144. Now, some of those that are up there are probably well-known passages to you, but let's read out of this psalm for a moment. Look at Psalm 144. It is a psalm of David. And I'm not going to take time to read the whole psalm. You can do that on your own. But notice how he begins. Blessed be the Lord, my strength. Now notice down in verse 15. Happy is that people that is in such a case. Yea, happy is that people. A lot of your translations may say blessed is that people. But happy or blessed is that people whose God is the Lord. Now this word happy or blessed, the reason I put up there that it brings happiness, it brings a knowledge of approval. When you look at the Beatitudes in Matthew 5, or you look at those phrases in 1 Peter 3 about the Christian, even in the midst of persecution and so forth, is happy. Happy are those that endure and so forth. It's a word that means blessed, but it is also a word that means you're happy or you're blessed because you know that what you're doing brings approval. Let me say it like this. Especially when you were a kid, when you were a child. Did you ever do something? Did you ever go to the playground, for example? That's what I usually think about because it really illustrates the point. I remember going to the playground as a little kid and climbing the monkey bars for the first time. Now, my mom, when I was a little kid, she was a worrywart, and she would always, you know, you can't climb the monkey bars. I see the other kids climbing the monkey bars. I want to climb the monkey bars. But she was worried I'd climb up there and fall off. But I remember when I got to a certain age, right before school age, and I went over to those monkey bars and I climbed up those monkey bars. And then to her complete horror, I laid back off the bar, you know, draping my legs over, you know exactly what kids do. And then upside down, I yelled across the playground there. She was on the bench, and I said, hey, Mama! And I was completely expecting that I'd get this bright, beaming smile, this total approval, you know, all of it. And that feeling inside of believing what you're doing is going to bring great approval, a big smile. That's exactly what this word means. That's why you're happy. Now, naturally, in that story, I didn't get the smile, you know, if you can imagine. But I thought I was going to get it, so that was the point. But happy, blessed, you know, approval, it brings that. I'll tell you something else, too. Godliness brings contentment. Passages show it. James read for us the passage. Paul saying, I've learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith to be content. I've learned that. We ought to really focus on that verse. Because, you know, sometimes people say, well, I just can't be satisfied with wherever I am. Nobody can. You just can't be. And you're exactly right. But you can learn to be. And that's the difference. And that's exactly what Paul was saying. Paul was in prison when he wrote that. And when he wrote this epistle talking about how happy he was, how full of joy he was, he'd been beat up, literally, thrown in prison, and he'd been there maybe for 3 or more years at the time he wrote that. But he had learned. He was content. And he'd learned to be content. I'll tell you something else, too. There's a great deal of emotional harm that results from not living godly. You know, when you do what's wrong, if you have a conscience, and we all do, and if yours is still active, if it's working like God meant it to, it bothers you. And the more wrong you do, the more it bothers you. It bothers you all the time. Now, we train ourselves, and it's unfortunate, but we train ourselves not to think about it. I'm just not going to think about it. We train ourselves to busy ourselves doing something else. I've sinned, so what do? Well, I immediately run do something else. Why? Because my mind gets occupied with that. I don't think about what I've just done. We train ourselves to do that. And eventually, if we work hard enough at it, we can sear our conscience. We can, as much as if you put a hot iron to your skin and you just keep burning it, it'll eventually get to the point where there's no feeling. You can rub your fingers over it, no feeling whatsoever. That's a weird thing. If you've ever been cut on before and the nerves haven't grown back, you know exactly what that's like. You know you're rubbing it, but you just don't feel it. You can train yourself so your mind doesn't bother you. Your emotions don't bother you anymore. You just sin and you don't care. But until you get to that point, there's a lot of emotional duress you go through. And you know that. And I know that. And it hurts. You don't like it. You have to live with it. And that's the way you tell yourself, I've just got to live with this. It's what goes with doing whatever it is I'm doing. What God says is you don't have to live with it. And you don't have to do it. You can submit to me and do what's right and live a godly life. Yeah, you'll go through some hard times on the way to controlling yourself. But once you're there, it won't be that you have to be seared, you know, no feeling. No, you'll have feeling, but you just won't be going through the emotional hurt. You can save yourself a lot of emotional harm by just simply following the Lord. Godliness profits in this life, the life that now is. Socially, let me just suggest something really quickly to you. I know you know this passage, that evil companions corrupt good morals. Are evil communications corrupt good ways? Or any of a number of ways that's translated. Godly people choose their companions well, and they're careful about that. Godly people know that they associate with people in the world, and else you'd have to go out of the world. And so they're going to be people you know and people that you work with and so forth and so on that are not godly. You and I know that. But those that I'm going to spend the most amount of time with, those that I'm the closest to, those that are going to be part of my life, and my life is going to be just intertwined with, I want to choose them well. Why? Why is that so important? I want you to think about something. Going back to that book of Philippians, think about something that Paul said. Philippians chapter 1 and verse 3, Paul said, and I quote, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. I want you to think about that phrase for a moment. How many people do you think there are in the world who can truly say that? Not about everybody. Not even Paul could say that. There are plenty of people he couldn't say that about. But he had a group of friends there in Philippi that he could say to them, every time I think of you, I thank God for you. How good were those people? How well had Paul chosen to have such a group of friends? How many people in the world can truly say that? And I'll say it like this about any group of people in their lives. Every time I think about them, I thank God for them. If you choose your friends, your wife, your husband, etc., if you choose them well, and if you have that opportunity to do that, you'll be able to say that. You'll think about your wife or your daughter or your son or your husband or whatever the case might be, your friends, and you'll be thankful to God for them. Every time you think of them. You go away and you're in a different city and you'll think about your wife and your daughter back home and you'll thank God for them. You'll look forward to seeing them again. It won't be like people in the world so many times, boy, I need some time away from that person. Maybe their husband or their wife, they need to be away from them. Or, I wish my kids would just grow up and get out of my life. I'll be honest with you. I don't think that way, and I don't have to think that way. I don't want to think that way. Godly people put forth effort to choose well. One final thing. Paul said, the promise of the life that now is and the one that has come. Obviously, godliness brings spiritual blessing, but it brings it in this life. All spiritual blessings to those that are godly. It certainly brings it in the life that is to come. Read with me, if you will, one passage and we'll close. Read with me in Mark chapter 10. This was the case when the rich young ruler had come to Jesus. And to put it like I did earlier, Jesus had told him, you need to take a vow of poverty. What Jesus said was, you need to sell everything you have and give it away because that's your God. And you need to put that out of your life. And then you come follow me. You know, it was at the end of this passage, and we'll just drop down to the end of it, that Peter began to say, and I like the way Mark puts that. It means that Peter asked him this more than once. He began to say unto him, lo, we have left all and followed you. Now, if you know the story of Peter, Peter had a business, had a family, and so forth. Peter left his life, and that didn't mean he left his wife now. No, she went with him, is the point. But the life he had of being a businessman there on the Sea of Galilee, fishing and all that that he was doing, left it all behind. We've left everything, Peter said, and we followed you. And Jesus answered and said, and in fact, if you look at Matthew, he goes on to ask the question, and what do we get for that? What's the profit in it? Jesus answered and said, verily I say unto you, there is no man that has left house, or brothers, or sister, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my sake and the gospel's, but he shall receive 100-fold. Now in this time, notice that, now in this time, houses, and brothers, and sisters, and mother, and children, and lands, with persecutions, and in the world to come, eternal life. Jesus is very honest here. Yeah, you're going to have persecutions. I'm not trying to stand up here and say, boy, if you'll obey the gospel today, everything's going to be perfect in your life. I think I've said enough in the sermon so you know that's not so. But what God has said is you're going to profit, and profit greatly, if you'll live godly. Are you here this morning, and you've never obeyed the gospel? You believe in Jesus, but you've never yet publicly confessed that He is the Son of God and you want Him to be your Lord.